Thank you, everyone. Wanted to introduce the second panel, the early stage developers perspective on offshore, moderated by Sam Gabita from Element Partners. Element Partners is a private equity fund focused on growth investments in the clean technology and energy sector. And Sam has experience from the investor's perspective in investing in Wasatch Wind, which has an offshore position. So has a unique perspective himself to lend to the discussion in respect of how the financial community looks at these opportunities. So, Sam?
Great. Thanks, Josh. Can everyone hear me? I'm not sure the mics are totally working, but if everyone can hear, I think we're probably going to be okay. Great. Can you speak a little closer? Is that better? I'm not sure the mics are... Is it working now? Okay. Well, I'll just yell about myself and then let the other guys be quiet. So thanks to Goodwin Procter and GE for putting this together. It's a great opportunity, and just from listening to the quality of the questions from the audience, it certainly seems like we have a very educated group in here. So Josh mentioned a little bit about our background. Element's a private equity firm managing about $800 million, typically doing growth investing, not early stage technology-oriented companies, but our perspective on wind energy and wind development in particular is that investing in early stage wind developers can be an attractive way to take a de-risked approach and still make sort of private equity like returns. And so far, knock on wood, that experience has been working for us. Josh mentioned our investment in Wasatch. Wasatch Wind is a early stage wind developer with a sort of substantial portfolio in the Intermountain West. But also a very interesting position on the Canadian side of Lake Erie. And so that's been sort of our initial foray and exposure into offshore wind energy. But let me go ahead and introduce the other panelists. Tim, you want to start off?
Yeah, Tim Ryan. I'm the president of Apex Offshore Wind. We're part of one of three businesses within Apex Wind Energy. Apex is a relatively new company established at the beginning of last year. We have about 45 people now. Headquarters is in Charlottesville. Offices also in Poughkeepsie, New York, and Erie, PA, where I am. The three businesses that we have are offshore wind, what we call greenfield, which is large farm and ranch projects, and then distributed, which is formerly called brownfield, which is small and medium-sized projects in urban and industrial locations, ports, and so forth. We see a lot of synergies between those distributed sites, many of which are coastal, such as the project we completed in Lackawanna, New York, right next to Buffalo on the shore of Lake Erie. Privately held company, the predecessor to Apex was Greenlight Energy, which was also a Charlottesville company. And for those the investors in the room, that company was started in the year 2000, completed two projects, one in Colorado, one in Kansas, and had a fairly large pipeline that was sold to BP at the end of 2006 for quite a large multiple on invested capital. So good track record there.
Good afternoon. I'm Mike Medea, and thank you also to GE and Goodwin Procter. I'm very pleased to be here. I'm Chief Operating Officer of Fisherman's Energy. My background is more than 25 years in engineering, project finance, and development, including working for the likes of Bechtel, ABB Energy Ventures, and more than 11 years as Chief Operating Officer of Con Edison Development. Built that business and divested it. About $1.5 billion plus business with more than 2,000 megawatts in 16 different locations. Joined Fisherman's more than a year ago because it's a model like none that I've seen. It's it's taking an opposition group and cultivating that opposition group, a group that was formerly opposed to offshore wind. And when they first saw offshore wind being talked about along the East Coast, they were very concerned because their livelihood is dependent upon sustainability of the environment and of the ocean. Our investors represent some of the leading East Coast commercial fishing companies with 100 vessels from Virginia to Massachusetts, one of the top two and three scallop companies, one of the leading clam companies, one of the leading mackerel companies, and a host of others. So our approach has been to work with environmental groups, act as a really a group to bring the stakeholders really into the process. For example, we've opened up our computer FTP site to environmental groups to look at our permit applications. We're advancing a state waters. You heard demonstration scale project in the first panel. We have a 6-turbine project located 2.8 miles off Atlantic City. Our permit applications with New Jersey DEP and U.S. Army Corps have both been deemed complete. We expect permits from New Jersey late this year and Army Corps first quarter 2011. We're very much active in the economic development process in New Jersey, which is really the reason for the creation of the legislation. It was great to say global warming and environmental reasons are what supports renewables. That's a really tough sell in a $4 natural gas environment. So now we've been working on bringing industry along with the projects to New Jersey, and we're active in the creation of the legislation, which you heard earlier, the OREC legislation, which is actually called the Offshore Wind Development Act, that has provisions in it for 1,100 megawatts of generation, but it also has $100 million in tax credits available for supply chain manufacturing in certain port districts. So with that, I'll turn it over to Chris.
Good afternoon. I am Chris Wissman from Great Lakes Wind Energy. I'm very, very pleased to be here. I have instructions to help keep everybody awake through the end of the day. So I have two questions for you to start off, sort of to get to know the audience. How many here folks would consider that they have a technical background? Just a show of hands. Okay. And then how many on, the finance side or finance and legal, all as one? Okay, good, good. So a third, and then there's a third that haven't raised their hand somewhere about. So either unsure or none of those categories. Well, then maybe you can appreciate this, my background in offshore wind. It started in 2002, where I was first introduced to the concept through an ex-partner, and he described wind turbines in the ocean off of Long Island, cables stretching, who knows where. And my first response was, it's really cool, but my career is not long enough to see that ever happen. So I can appreciate those in the room that see this for the first time. I think since then, over those couple of years, from 2002 to about 2004, I started to see the big guys in the business. As you become aware of something, you start to read about it. I saw GE, I saw Siemens, and other major companies entering the offshore wind field. And lo and behold, 2005, we actually started a company that is now known as Deepwater Wind, and just today announced its newly scaled 1,000-megawatt project in Rhode Island Sound, incorporating an electric transmission line from Massachusetts down to New York. We started that company in 2005, basically 2 weeks before Congress passed the Energy Policy Act, which had a mandate to regulate offshore wind or ocean renewables in 270 days to come up with permitting. As time ticked on, it suddenly became 1,200 days or so before MMS actually came out with those rules. And lo and behold, I earlier this year started a new company focused exclusively on offshore wind in the Great Lakes. So what I bring here is a perspective of focusing on the Great Lakes, because that's where we really think the commercial scale projects will flourish first. Bechtel, we have partnered with Bechtel on our Ohio project. We earlier this year won the franchise for the Ohio waters of Lake Erie to develop up to 1,000 megawatts. So with that, thank you, Sam.
Terrific. So I think it's pretty clear that we've got a kind of excellent sampling of offshore developers. And one question that I think would help frame the rest of the discussion here is we see that a number of you guys have both traditional energy development experience as well as onshore wind development experience. So, the $4 billion question, as the case may be, is why'd you get into offshore?
That's a great question. I guess, am I always going to be first?
You are.
We'll see how it goes. I got involved in offshore in 2002 when I was in New York with Arcadia Wind Power and co-founded Blue Water Wind. We started that company to go after the Long Island Power Authority offshore our solicitation, and it looked like it was about maybe 5 years out to see offshore wind in the U.S., and then the next year was 5 years, and you know, every year was still 5 years out. But actually, about in 2007, it started to look like, well, the clock is ticking. So we actually see things in 2012 or 13, you know, somewhere in North America. We see relative to land-based wind, and we do land-based wind as well as offshore wind. So there are a lot of similarities. There are also a lot of differences. One thing with our headquarters in Virginia and our offices in Pennsylvania and New York, we see that as a way to play locally. And another thing is that we see that this is it's really a transformational scale relative to land-based wind, particularly on the East Coast. These aren't projects ultimately of 10 megawatts or 50 or 100 or 2 or 200 or 500 megawatts. It's, 1,000 megawatt projects like Deepwater announced are going to be routine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mike? I would say if one looks back again at the Energy Policy Act, it had national transmission corridors in there. Well, none of those projects have really gone forward because of local jurisdictional issues primarily. So if you look at the United States, where 70% of the population and the load is generally on the coast, the East Coast has, with this dense population and high electric load, it makes perfect sense for generation to be located in close proximity to load. That's what a number of large utilities have said over the years. And rather than string transmission lines from the Midwest, which a lot of folks who have invested in terrestrial wind would love to do, that's a tall order. So it makes sense to put this generation, which, as Tim mentioned, for utility-scale renewables, we're not going to find that available in most of the East Coast. We don't have the irradiance that the Southwest has for large-scale solar. We don't have the winds like the T. Boone Pickens Corridor has. So offshore wind is really that next frontier of creating renewable energy in close proximity to load.
What they said, pretty much. I mean, really, it's that there's an immense opportunity really, really close to population centers. I have spent a large part of my career right here in New York and Long Island. And New York and Long Island electrically are basically barely connected to the rest of the continent. So offshore wind seemed like a perfect solution. Imagine siting new power plants really to feed New York City or Long Island, or the transmission lines across the Hudson. Those battles go on for years and years. So it seemed like a really logical solution. I think the one thing that we really are up against is the cost. You couldn't power New York City and Long Island cost effectively today. So one of the things what encouraged me early in this was, I guess now what I would call is the hope and the promise that we can go a long ways down the cost curve. And as technology really advances, as we figure out how to install these cost effectively, that we can start to be reasonably competitive with what I would call islanded power. Islanded power being New York City and Long Island that really have a very high cost of power.
Yeah, I think you got a great sense for sort of motivation. And I think I'll get into this in a minute, but geography obviously plays a huge factor. But our perspective from a private equity standpoint is typically we started to think about it as an extension of the onshore wind strategy. But the beauty of offshore, I think you heard from all three panelists here, is that the geographies that they've chosen are actually relevant to the load that they're serving. And if you can do that cost effectively, certainly the cost curves in wind have come down onshore in a very attractive way. Of course, gas prices have as well, but that's a separate issue. So let's talk a little bit about geography. That is something that the three of you sort of don't quite have in common. Can you talk a little bit about, I'll start with Chris, just to mix it up
a little bit. Yeah. Well, I think geography for me is really, is not just physically where things are, but it's how regulations impact with the development of this industry. Everything basically in the salt water from 3 miles out is regulated by what was once Minerals Management Services, BOMM. And
that regulatory structure has more or less, I think, now been shortened to more or less a six-year term for permitting, arguably 6 years. Nobody's really been through it before. And from my perspective, when you look at moving to the Great Lakes, you've fallen into an entirely different regulatory regime. You fall under what I would call the older Army Corps type structure, which has a arguably much faster runway to permitting, arguably 3 years. And that's not really with any environmental analysis shortcuts. It's a different way of handling sort of bureaucracy, public notices, all that kind of stuff. So for me, it came down to be that simple. What is the fastest route to real utility scale deployment? Now I think Rich Reno pointed out very, very appropriately that the winds are not as great in the Great Lakes. But I think that's somewhat mitigated by a lot easier construction. You don't have the massive waves. You've got generally shallower water. You've actually got big old fallow ports. One of the challenges with the East Coast is, with real estate so valuable, many of the ports that had actually really good access without having to go under bridges and such have been redeveloped into something, whether they're, shopping centers or residential facilities. And what you find in the Great Lakes is you've got a lot of big old, we talked about Port of Buffalo. Well, Ohio alone has three or four ports that are just sitting there right on the waterfront with no obstacles. So it just looked like an easier pathway. That was my perspective.
It's going to get spicy now, I guess, because you guys are both in the ocean. So.
Well, from a fisherman's energy perspective, it's really where our founders came from, coupled with state policies. They saw that New Jersey was looking at renewables in general, and the state had commissioned a study that at the time, AWS Scientific, they were at that time, did that study and came up with if New Jersey was going to meet an RPS requirement of 20%, the only way to do it was with offshore wind. So our founders studied the state. That policies in the state moved from that to a blue ribbon panel that was created by acting Governor Cody, and then after that, Governor Corzine had the Energy Master Plan, which had a target of 1,000 megawatts of offshore wind by 2012, which we know is not going to happen because of the OEMRE schedule, a timeline. But there is 3,000 megawatts as the target by 2020. New Jersey also offers some variables that are conducive to offshore wind. It's a shallow, sandy bottom, very good for constructability. We can go 2.8 miles out, so right inside the state mile, the state federal line, and the water depths are 35 to 40 feet, so very constructible. Even for a large utility scale project that may be 10 to 12 miles out, we're in 75 feet of water. Again, very, very constructible, known, common to a number of projects in Europe. So those ingredients made for our selection of New Jersey first. But we have looked and we are continuing to look at other jurisdictions.
We're a little different from both of these in that Apex is involved both in the Great Lakes and the Atlantic Coast. More specifically, we're developing projects in Lake Erie and in the Middle Atlantic, being Virginia and North Carolina at this point, where we submitted lease applications to the Department of Interior. Maybe one reason that we look at both is that we've got people in Pennsylvania, people in New York, and both of those touch on the Great Lakes and have access at least to the Atlantic coast. So we just see both sides. We certainly look for we need to have a view toward offtake that there's isn't necessarily an RFP for a power purchase agreement, although that sometimes comes up, but just a view that at some point before hopefully too long while the careers are still in place, there will be some offtake that most. In all likelihood, offshore wind is going to be contracted as opposed to being merchant. We also look for technical factors in terms of wind speed and water depth, and we see those in both places. A little different than some of the earlier movers that in Massachusetts in particular and New England, where there's more of an environmental emphasis toward offshore wind. Our focus is more on jobs, economic development, and the environmental benefits are nice, but it's more about jobs and economic development, where that's you know the activity, and then part of it as well is where we can have a first mover advantage going someplace. So we were the first company to file a lease application off the coast of Virginia, for instance, and finally we pick our geography based on where we have a very strong connection. So we have a lot of people in Virginia. We have people in New York, Pennsylvania. So it really and when we went into North Carolina, we acquired a company that had some very strong a very strong presence there. So it's very very important to have a thorough understanding of the local market, the constituency, the state government, and so forth.
Absolutely. So I think what I heard anyway from that was that there were certainly policy as an overriding factor or a major factor in terms of where you're focused. Constructability certainly came up and as a topic and local presence. Maybe I'll switch gears a little bit to a topic that's near and dear to my heart, capital efficiency. As you build your organizations and as you think about what it takes to get a project to, let's use the European term, fully consented. What does that mean? I mean, from our perspective as a private equity investor, our experience is that when you're focusing on offshore, the pro is that you can build a smaller, more focused organization because your site is sort of limited and you don't have 50 people running around trying to sign up land. On the other hand, timelines are extended. So how do you guys think about organization and spend as it relates to the megawatts that you're trying to develop? Maybe I'll start in the middle.
Thank you, Sam. From our perspective, it's been a very lean organization, tapping people that have had maritime and commercial fishing expertise that knew the water, and coupling that with third-party experts and some people from the energy and project finance industry like myself. So we've kept a very lean project development model and used resources and consultants when required. We have seen, as Sam mentioned, the timelines are getting longer, so that does put a strain on capital. We've gone back and done a second, what we call a Series A1 raise with our initial commercial industry investors, and we're working with a boutique investment bank on a development capital raise specifically for our project. So it is a more difficult environment than what I saw in the conventional generation or even the terrestrial wind environment. In a former life, I was in a wind joint venture that amassed about 500 megawatts of terrestrial capacity, and at that time, capital was freely flowing. It is a tougher environment now, but we've managed to raise the capital necessary, and we focus that on real concrete type efforts to advance projects. We've put a wind monitoring buoy out at our Atlantic City project location, 2.8 miles out in the ocean. We've done geotechnical work. We've been told by contractors that we have more geotechnical work results right now than some of the other projects you may have heard about. We drilled all six locations for our New Jersey project, as well as done full vibrocore and benthic work along our cable route and our turbine array field. So we've put our capital into items that really advance project development and where we could show concrete results to investors.
Well, I think one thing it's important to understand is that offshore wind almost bears no resemblance to land-based wind, other than that there are wind turbines ultimately erected. There's a natural pace to developing the offshore projects that is largely not a function of how much money you deploy. It's a function of regulatory regimes and pacing and certain amount of engineering. We'll contrast that with land-based development, which is directly proportional to how many feet you have on the ground, right? Payroll, how much you're putting out the door to get land entitlements, and it's pretty much all within the reach of just deciding to do it and doing it. Whereas offshore, a lot of it is essentially waiting for regulators, making small steps at a time. So I think there's almost no model other than being lean. Now, that said, there are a couple of absolutely critical elements that are necessary. This is a lot more engineering intensive. This is also a lot more permitting intensive. There's the whole NEPA process for offshore wind is largely non-existent for most of the land-based projects. So there's a couple of real key sort of staff positions that are necessary. You can't do it with one guy out of the back of a truck.
I certainly don't disagree with lean. Our offshore activities are are done on a pretty frugal basis. Our approach is to have that we have Apex Wind Energy Holdings, which is our overall company, development capital is raised at that level, and we have a diversified mix of activity. So we have about 45 people, for instance, and there may be half of those or 15 of those at some point or other are involved in offshore wind, whether it's meteorology or real estate or legal or interconnection or what have you. We have several people that mostly focus on offshore. So we have, sort of that, the bill like Bechtel, much smaller scale, but we have the ability to draw on the other resources in the company without either going outside or hiring in those additional resources. Diversification, also comes into play with investors or with our investors in terms of, hey, the land-based wind may be shorter term, smaller dollars, smaller projects potentially than offshore, and maybe that balances with the longer term, larger dollars for offshore. In terms of development cost, a land-based wind relative to offshore wind, it's somewhere between a 10 and 20x multiple of development cost for offshore wind relative to land-based wind. And so the pacing is going to be a little bit different. Land-based wind will just, go out and throw up a 60-meter met tower or a few of those, or maybe an 80-meter tower. Offshore, we'll have a land lease, but without having, interconnection or anything, visibility toward offtake. Whereas offshore, we're just not going to do that. It's, the pacing is a little bit different. I certainly agree with Chris that offshore wind, it's sort of is very, very different than land-based wind. The paradox is it's also very, very similar to land-based wind. I think that it's sort of different from land-based wind the way clean coal is different from traditional coal. When we think about cost of offshore wind, one of the things that we like to point out is, it's a new technology. We need some early adopters at the federal government level, at the state level, perhaps. But it's not all that different cost-wise than some of the other things that are happening. There's a $3.5 billion capital cost project that was just recently permitted. Power generation, 602 megawatts, I think. So that's $5,800 a megawatt. Is this offshore wind? No, it's an advanced coal with I think 2/3 sequestration in Illinois, federal loan guarantees. Very very big emphasis on jobs, and let's use our in-state resources, maybe that's more of the model than a land-based wind project of Shepherd Flat, for instance, which is 700 megawatts.
I gave you guys an opening to beat up on solar, and you haven't, in terms of installed cost.
We have a sister company that does solar, but that's the installed cost of solar is pretty comparable. If you like solar, you should love offshore wind, because you can do the same, only bigger.
Absolutely.
Just look at the SREC pricing alone, and offshore wind, if we can drive down costs and get the efficiencies that we've been talking about, whether it's buying turbines in pools, whether it's getting larger vessels here, we may be talking about offshore wind prices similar to what you've seen in the Rhode Island and Massachusetts PPAs in the mid sort of 20-cent range, or let's say $250 a megawatt hour. SRECs are trading at over $600 for solar. We know the efficiency of solar is in the 15% range. Offshore wind is going to be in the 35 to 40% range. So it certainly, beats solar on those elements.
See, I opened the floodgates. That's all we're going to hear. The rest.
We're actually working on legislation that will characterize offshore wind as solar, just to get around all this discussion.
Perfect. So one thing that that certainly has been our experience as we have seen our little offshore company develop is the importance of bringing in strategic investors, which could sort of go anything from EPC folks to traditional energy folks that may have mineral rights in your areas of interest. What's been your experience on that front? Because that certainly seemed seemed to strike a chord when we started thinking about offshore.
Well, ultimately, I think large off-scale wind projects are probably going to be jointly owned, we think, like many nuclear plants are jointly owned, or many offshore oil projects are jointly owned. The famous Deepwater Horizon was, you know, there's none, the partners came out when the rig blew up. And just the scale of a 1,000 megawatt project, maybe that's $3 to $5 billion of capital. You're going to need multiple investors. There is a question as to what's the timing in terms of bringing those in, because you know, there's a trade-off. Generally, the lower the cost of capital, the later in the process they want to get involved in the a project. And so it's a real balance between risk and size.
Yeah, absolutely. And this sort of touches on the last panel as well, in terms of coordinating the supply chain a little bit and how much effort that takes to sort of localize the supply chain and be sure you can deliver to the Great Lakes, as an example. But any further comments on that?
Well, yeah, I wanted to pick up on the strategic investor. I think at this early stage, I mean, we're really talking about, I would say, the real projects that are poised here domestically. You can count on about a hand right now. And I think it's very important for strategic investors. We're certainly in Ohio testing out the model of working with Bechtel as an early stage developer and with Bechtel as the EPC as well. And part of that is because it's a very small project. There is real value on the part of the strategic investor to get a resume on a small project before you're betting the farm on a billion-dollar scale project. So it kind of works for the strategic investor. It works also on the financial side for us, because early stage of development capital is hard to come by, but it also makes the ultimate financing on a small project able to work without having to pay too much of a penalty, because the project just ultimately isn't that big.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, we see it as the first panel mentioned, as a collaboration among strategic players and participants. And having been out in the market with Fieldstone Private Capital, we've had these same discussions with well-known utilities, subsidiaries, turbine vendors, cable companies, et cetera, as to what phase of the project they would be interested in participating more than just as a supplier partner. There are those challenges of price, and specifically to New Jersey, where the legislation is more equivalent to a utility rate case than a PPA for an IPP project. That offshore renewable energy credit legislation, now you notice they called it something similar. They called it an OREC instead of an SREC, but it looks nothing like an SREC. It's not a tradable instrument. What it'll be is very much a equivalent, somewhat like a feed-in tariff, but equivalent to a 20-year PPA. But the burden is on the developer to present this essentially what is an open book pricing plan to the Board of Public Utilities in New Jersey, and that requires intense collaboration among the contractor, the engineer, the turbine supplier, and the developer, because that price buildup has to be something that's defended, again, similar to the way a rate case is defended.
Great insights. That was really helpful. So maybe to fast forward a little bit to, I guess, current events that are going on in your world, maybe we could get some comments around Cape Wind for starters, and then the Atlantic Connector.
Great project.
Oh, okay, great, perfect. And then the Atlantic Connection, which is also a fairly significant announcement in your industry.
I'll go. We know the Atlantic Connection folks, Transelect, and the work they've done on land. It's an ambitious proposition. Likely that line, I know from being an electrical engineer first, that line will actually be functional whether any offshore wind is built or not. You know, the type of electricity flows really from the southeast to the north could ultimately be of value. It may not move renewable energy, though. It may be moving nuclear or coal-based energy. But regardless of whether that line goes or not, the first phase developers, which are really the unsolicited bids in Virginia, the three federal developers that have BOE MRE leases in New Jersey, which are Fisherman's Energy, Deepwater, Garden State Offshore, and Blue Water, each of those developers, at least the New Jersey developers, has its PJM interconnection queue position. So we can connect this capacity in the system to build that 1,100 megawatts in New Jersey without the Atlantic connection. So, long term, if we're going to have the proliferation like we've seen in Europe, something approaching multi-gigawatts of offshore wind, we think that line is terrific. It's not needed initially, though.
Right, I'd have to agree with that, but it's very similar to the model of the supergrid in Europe. I mean, Europe is just so far ahead in the thinking in offshore wind, right? The concept of some of the transmission lines there is literally to use the hydropower in Scandinavia as the balancing power for the intermittency of offshore wind, right? So you have massive transmission lines. I would argue that they're maybe a little bit ahead of their time. We don't need it to get the first offshore projects going, but I also think they can be on the skeptic side and say they never need offshore wind to plug into that to make the line work. So you've got a good transmission line in and of itself. Mm-hmm. That's for sure. Now, with regard to Cape Wind, I think everybody knows that that's not the blueprint that anybody's looking at for development history. I think Cape Wind had to live through a complete change in permitting regime, starting with the Army Corps of Engineers and getting a long ways along there, and then going back to square one. So grandfathered or not, they still had to live with complying with rules that weren't made yet. So there's just, I don't think that will be repeated by any offshore wind developer.
Tim, anything? Technically, the Cape Wind project is enviable. Windy, shallow, protected from ocean waves, close to high-priced power. No ships go by. Technically, it's a wonderful project. It's had, it's in a very high-priced neighborhood, and for whatever reasons, it's been it's just taking a long time. There is tremendous support. I was very encouraged when. 3 years ago, maybe the Massachusetts Audubon released the study, the results of their independent study, and found there were no environment, no avian issues, anything with that. And I think the three of us at the table and a number, most everybody else in the room has benefited from the sort of path, trailblazing that Cape Wind has done in many ways. So that's to be appreciated. They seem to be well underway in terms of steps along the road. The offshore transmission in concept is a great idea. It's much easier to, in theory, to get permits for submarine cables that nobody ever sees than transmission cables of similar capacity that are on utility poles that everybody sees. And in theory, you can have grids and lines going from one place to another and do a lot of wonderful things. It's sort of like this. There's with the offshore wind farms and the cable. One is the chicken, the other's the egg. Which comes first? And I'm not sure which one's the chicken. Which one's the egg?
Absolutely. I guess thinking about the future, if we can think about the next 5 years or the next 10 years, there's clearly been a model evolving in Europe as to the ultimate owners of offshore wind projects. We're in a terrific interest rate environment. We've got some well-capitalized utilities. Certainly the European model and exit values paid for consented projects are attractive. What do you all think about exit opportunities in the U.S. and ultimate owners of these projects?
Well, I guess I'll speak to that first. I think Todd had brought up, wherever Todd went to, The European concept where the first sort of generation of projects were built small and then they became true utility scale projects. And I think utility scale projects absolutely dominated by the big energy companies, Dong, E.ON, and the like. And what you see here is three relatively small developers. And I think it's a, it's likely to follow the exact path of the Europeans, where it ultimately within a decade becomes dominated by the big balance sheet oriented energy companies once they're comfortable with the technology. So I think that that exit premium for the domestic energy companies is only after there's a couple of functioning projects that literally they can almost touch and feel and become comfortable with. But it should become about the same, you know, sort of exact premium.
I agree with what Chris said. Our perspective is that, and we show this in some of our presentation materials, is we're comfortable working on the water. So we see a role for Fisherman's Energy and its investors in operations and maintenance. And that may not be sort of turning wrenches or fixing turbines, but it will be in ferrying services and equipment out to the wind farm and in day-to-day operations. So those are the type of discussions we've had with the turbine suppliers, with the O&M suppliers. And our model is one that looking to attract outside capital. So, you know, we do see that sell down, but with some continued minority ownership.
I think we'll have to see what Apex looks like, 5 and 10 years from now. Whether we are an IPP of some scale, or not. I'm not sure I agree with the view that ultimately U.S. offshore wind is largely going to be owned by utilities. If we're thinking about 50 gigawatts by 2030 or 54 gigawatts, which is the Department of Energy target, that's $150 billion, $200 billion. I'm not sure that there's that capacity for capital within the utility sector. Particularly if they're also going to be phasing out of coal and doing natural gas as well as offshore wind. We do see perhaps more infrastructure investment, similar perhaps to what the Danish Pension Fund just did, where they bought half of the operating Nysted project from the utility there. So perhaps it's a hybrid of energy, utility companies and other energy companies as well as infrastructure investors.
Yeah, absolutely fair point. So at this point, maybe we can just open it up for a few questions.
We're between everybody and their cocktails,
perfect.
Right? So I mean,
yeah.
It's like no chance.
Well, at least in terms of New Jersey, PSE&G is a partner with Deepwater in Garden State Offshore. So they participated in the first solicitation. It's been no secret that they'd like to build another nuclear plant. They've had forays into solar. Will they stay in offshore wind? That remains to be seen. I do think utilities can serve a role, though. As we all push to drive down the cost to make offshore wind more competitive, we could have transmission lines even beyond the Atlantic connection, but take the transmission, the substation, et cetera, and put that in the utility scope. Those are things they know how to do. Their cost of capital is less than an IPP project. So that could be a component to helping to reduce cost and for the utilities having a role.
Now, I have to say, when I put together Garden State Offshore with partnering with PSEG, we were all sort of scratching our heads and maybe a little bit skeptical about the motivation. It is a local, this is a local sport, and to a great extent, the utilities are political animals, and they need to work. Their ultimate customers are the respective public utility commissions and public service commissions from whom they need to gain approval on other things. What could be better than having a big green project when you're also going for the concession on a big dirty project? So I think what you're going to find is it's very local. And I think PSEG was a unique animal. I think there are other unique animals. I don't think that you could generalize about the utilities at large. I mean, a lot of the traditional utilities don't exist anymore, right? Through deregulation, they're just wires companies. So I think it's I think there will be a few that will step in early. And as Tim said, the energy companies here in the U.S. are different than the energy companies in Europe. So I think he's absolutely right. It's not going to be just the energy companies that step in as the buyout of developers, but really a mix, a consortium.
Well, there's two kinds of utilities. I mean, there's more than that, but there are the integrated utilities like Southern Company that they own the transmission, they own the distribution, they have the retail customers, and they also own the generation. And when they build, like they're building, planning to build a couple of big nuclear plants, they're going to rate base that and, charge that to their retail customers, and that's that. And then there are the New York type utilities where National Grid or Con Ed own the wires. They have the customers, but they don't own the generation. And then there's the, there are a number of, what's confusing is that there are a number of utility companies like NextEra, Florida Power and Light, or Duke, or PSE&G, Mission Energy, Edison, Southern California Edison and Edison Mission that do both. They have their own utility, and then they have their own independent power generation. I think in general the utility type companies are standing on the sidelines. There is some interest from a few of them. Perhaps it's going to be the strongest interest is going to be the ones that are already in renewables, in wind or in solar. I don't know that some utility that's really not developing or owning renewables is going to, take a big, leap into offshore wind. And for those that are involved in renewables, it'll probably be relatively slow. We do talk to potential strategic partners. One comment that I thought was kind of funny, but absolutely on point. We were talking to one European company, said, why don't you come back? Can you come back 2-3 years from now? And, we don't need as high a return. So, okay. But that's Frank's statement of reality.
Yes. Well,
did he say
that? You want to be the one. Yeah. You want to be the one without the arrows in your back? I guess that's the one. I think in this business, first of all, this is not offshore wind in the U.S. is not an industry yet. It's a couple of isolated projects that are yet to become an industry. So I think that's where the opportunity lies, is for investors to get a toe in the water on a project at a time. So that as it becomes an industry, we're poised with the management team and the know-how to then be able to turn it on and go for a much bigger proposition. I think that's the opportunity. Project by project, stick-built companies.
I think in our case, planning and promoting a demonstration scale type project has garnered tremendous support from New Jersey, from a number of the state agencies. Marlon Peterson's here from the Port District. We've had tremendous support throughout the state. Even when the Offshore Wind Development Act was being written, we were active with the other developers in helping to draft and create legislation. The legislation actually identifies a demonstration scale project located off a municipality that permits casino gambling. And our project was off Atlantic City, was already in the DEP permitting process at that point. So just being identified in the legislation was an indication of the type of support we've received in the state. Now, it doesn't mean we don't have to do all the environmental analysis, send out the transect surveys, count every whale, mammal, marine mammal, dolphin, and bird. We've been doing that, and we'll continue to do that. But the support for the project from state officials and local officials has been very encouraging.
We see some of the advantages that any early mover would see, which is that maybe you can get in and help to define the market. Maybe you can get in early enough so that there's uh, there's more upside for you than there is for the third or fourth entrant in the market. It is seen as pioneering. We've recruited people who coming out of business school or other programs who say, I could go with regular wind, but that's kind of old hat. Offshore wind is a chance to really be a pioneer, make a name for myself, and it's a lot of fun.
That last comment was very encouraging. If our young and bright MBAs, of which I was not one, are choosing that direction. And then obviously I think, the ultimate first mover advantage is great sites.
Right. Yeah. Real estate.
Well, thank you to the panel. This was a great discussion, and I hope it was helpful to the audience.
Great. Thanks. Thanks all.
Sure.